Welcome to the Unexplored Territory podcast. This week we have Chris Crowley as our guest. Chris is a master solution architect focusing on advanced computing, and we're going to talk about the role of language models in generative AI architectures. Hey Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to see you, Mr. Deniman.
So let's start with your career. How would you describe your current role in the new Broadcom organization? And maybe you can talk about your highlights of your career.
Yeah, so new role. Well, it's like, you know, kind of getting a new job all of a sudden again, right? But I think we're all navigating this new space, but it hasn't drastically changed for me specifically. I've been able to kind of retain sort of the same role. My charter really as an architect is to work with our strong OEM partners, you know, server partners really, to really stitch together innovation and technology that's based on a solutions sort of macro level outcome, right? And really help them understand where our technology has value, how it can help them add value to their platforms, and more importantly, how do we help them go to market jointly so we can be, you know, both be successful, but actually solve our customers' problems. That's the most critical part. If we can do that, then we'll both be successful naturally. And I've been very focused in the advanced computing space for the last, say, 3 or 4 years. And now, obviously, AI is the hot button, and everyone is, you know, hyper-focused on that. And so, naturally, you know, I've kind of been in the space for a couple of years now, and we were, if there's a few of us leading the charge kind of independently, and now everyone's lumping on, which is good, right? We're getting all the support we need. And so, you know, that's sort of the nutshell of what I'm doing from a career perspective, driving technology, enabling the OEMs to be successful, helping them, you know, adapt and move quickly to, you know, hold on to this AI rocket that's, you know, constantly refueling and never stopping. From a highlights of my career, you know, first one, obviously working with you, Frank, is one of the highlights. So that's a good thing, right? You know, but I think, you know, I've been privileged enough to have worked for lots of startup companies that I've seen go, you know, become successful. So I've seen sort of the serial entrepreneur happen, you know, in my career. I'd say that one of the biggest highlights, though, is being able to stay relevant through the changes of technology. That's not easy. I never kind of fell into a technology abyss and couldn't crawl my way out. I've been able to sort of stay above all the pitfalls and sort of navigate in a way that allowed me to feel like I had the freedom to learn and to be creative with the technology, but also be practical about, you know, business outcomes and outcome-based execution of the things that we're doing, right? And so I think that's probably one of the most challenging things for people in their careers. There's also very tactical things that, you know, I've been able to work with like OEMs to help design their platforms and make our software more sticky. We brought a embedded vSAN witness to market for the edge with an OEM vendor that I thought was pretty, you know, transformative for their business. So those are very tactical things that I've been able to accomplish. But I think overall it's, you know, navigating the craziness of the technology world successfully, which is not easy. And then the last piece is really about, you know, working with cool people and smart people and cultivating a space where we all can work together collectively and challenge ourselves. And I've also been pretty passionate about when I work with good people, bringing them with me. So how do I find, you know, if I change a role, how do I get them to come along with me and we can all keep navigating and keep going together? So that's always, you know, been really cool. And I've been able to accomplish that, I think, fairly well. And it's been able to allow me to continue to influence and drive, you know, innovation. So.
Yeah, so the key thing, what you said about staying relevant is very, very important. And it feels like if you are doing something, like you said, you're constantly learning things. I think that also, well, contributes to your own sense of worth, where you think like, hey, this stuff that I'm doing on a day-to-day basis actually makes a difference. And in the beginning of when you're tagging on to a new technology, it might not resonate with most people, but at, like you said, at one point, everybody started to pile on, especially in the AI space that we're both working in. Yeah, that, then it makes feel, then it gives you that feeling like, hey, what I'm doing is actually good and fun, right? And I think that's a very key element that you described. And so, especially with the focus of today's podcast about let's dive into the exciting world of Gen AI, and especially the models itself. So everybody knows about large language models, but there's a new thing on the horizon, or maybe it's not even new, but people are talking all of a sudden about small language models, or some would say small large language models, because we're still talking about a hefty model, right? So I don't know what the right term is. So let's use small language model, even though we're talking about more than a billion parameters, right?
Yeah.
And your expertise on the on-premises deployment is just fascinating. What you've been doing over the years is such an interesting thing. And I think let's explore during this episode about how SLMs will fit into the landscape.
Yeah, I think we'll have a, you know, there'll be way too many acronyms for us to even know. We'll need an AI bot or something to, you know, to digest all the acronyms. But if eventually I think it'll be right-sized LM, right? So you need the right-sized language model to that fits your use case. And I think, you know, so over time we'll see how that plays out. But I think, you know, small language models, again, are sort of this more progressive approach to how do I make these large language models easier to deal with, right, and to work with. So
I like the concept. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt.
No, you're good.
I like the concept, what you said about right-sized models. I think that's key. And I think that aligns with a lot of the IT ops approaches about, I have an infrastructure, I need to build an infrastructure, I need to size it accordingly to run my models. And at the same time, the data scientists, they need to figure out, okay, how can I run a model that actually can be accepted by the infrastructure? So right-sizing is something that multiple teams need to focus on. Yeah, that's a real good one. But before we actually talk about models, let's go over the components of a Gen AI application. Maybe that's, like you said, there's a lot of acronyms involved. Let's start with the basics. Let's level set everybody. So if you look at a Gen AI application, maybe even more focused on conversational AI, and you look at the role of a large language model, what type of other components are there that actually support such a model?
Yeah. So I guess it also, you know, that really depends on how you implement the model, right? But, you know, the latest buzzword is RAG. Obviously, everyone's really focused on how to enable a retrieval augmented generative architecture so they can take a commercially viable model off the shelf and not have to you know, mess with it much, but then add their knowledge sources within the path of that model to provide a more rich experience and better context. And I think that is very smart. I think it makes a lot of sense. It allows you to not abandon all the, you know, the databases and search that you've spent a lot of time on to make efficient. And it allows you to then pull all this really cool language model context in so it can help provide these really good answers. I think, but, you know, as you look at that architecture, and also, you know, it does add some complexity. Now I need a vector database. I've got to learn how to do all my embeddings. I've got to learn how to have very efficient search in that world, right? Because now I'm adding a sort of a layer of latency potentially. And so everybody's so focused on, you know, how many tokens can I process within milliseconds and what's the response time? And, you know, what I find is having the fastest response time is good for some things. But for the majority of things, I don't need sub, you know, 100 millisecond response time. I'm okay if I type a question and it takes a second, you know, or so to, you know, spit out some answers. I'm more focused on, are the answers good? and are they actually answering my question in a way that I can actually go do something, take some action? So I think, again, you know, there's been some hyper-focus on response time. I think it's important, but it's not the end-all be-all. I think the other thing is that if you're looking at, you know, a fine-tuned model where you're taking something, you haven't created the model yourself, but you're taking a model and you're trying to fine-tune that model with your context so that you can get a more precise answer and hopefully the model will hallucinate less. You know, those are simpler ways of implementing, right? So you've got just an API, you know, server there that you can talk to. You've got the models, you know, and so maybe some web services for your chatbot. And the, it's a little more streamlined, a little easier to implement. And I think in some ways can scale faster, right? In the nature of that world. But I think that's one of the biggest questions right now, and everyone's asking. You know, we're getting through some of the buzz of AI and Gen AI, and now we're starting to kind of feel a little bit of a hangover because we need to know, like, hey, how does this really scale? Like, how do I make this work for my business? Because I know that I have a desire to drive, you know, revenue and to be able to show KPIs that show how AI is influencing my business. And so I think there's going to be a wave of, you know, what does scalability look like and how does that change the architectures and how does that change, you know, how we use the models themselves across multiple applications, right, to reduce the footprint. No one wants everybody to have their own model. That would be a bad idea, right? I mean, unless it's very, very efficient, but I don't think we're there yet. If everyone had their own LLM, think about all the storage companies will be really happy because you're going to be eating up a ton of storage, right? The clouds will love it because you're, you know, obviously eating up a lot of their storage and paying for it. So I think the next wave is going to be scalability and efficiencies to help, you know, avert this sprawl of things and also to make sure that we're being smart about it because, you know, the world of acceleration also is accelerating our consumption of power. And honestly, I don't think we're thinking about it enough. And I think at some point we may hit a barrier, right? And that's going to be a rough road once we get there. So you hear people talk about Moore's Law and it's real, right? And we need to be respective of, you know, hey, do I need all these things? Do I need to have, you know, all this massive amount of data and all these flops and stuff? Are those really necessary for everyone? The answer is probably no. They're necessary for some of, you know, the big, you know, companies like Meta and others, right, where they're going to go create these things that are going to help evolve the practice longer term, meaning that how does it get distributed downstream and get consumed? But I think, you know, that's going to be the next real challenge is not just the components of the Gen AI and how they're delivered, because they're changing every day, by the way. So it's like I can tell you right now, go do this, go do X. Deliver your Gen AI model this way, and then tomorrow it'll change. So I think the answer is packaging is going to be really important. How do you package generative AI and language models so that the lay can actually understand how to deploy it and then deploy it with scale and probably not get as hung up on the how or like, you know, the nuts and bolts, right? It's going to be the packaging of these things so that we can scale them effectively and distribute them effectively over time. So again, kind of not a great answer because I don't think there is one answer, right, for how we do these things.
No, but one of the things that you said is really interesting. You said about scalability, like how will it scale? And if you're going to look at the current demos that we see a single large language model hitting a single vector database, and that will basically serve a single application, right? But in reality, so basically this aligns with your idea about, hey, for everybody, their own large language model. But in reality, that's not going to happen in enterprises, or at least that's my expectation, where we're going to see like, okay, you have a large language model that is pretty much focused on generating responses. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to connect it with data sources. That can be a vector database, that can be an agent tracking some other information. But how are we going to connect services to it? Will there be one large language model connected to multiple services, all hitting that large language model with an API? And how are we going to provide that large language model with the information? Are we going to use a single vector database? Are we going to use multiple vector databases? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think... Again, I think what I'd like to see, I guess, is I want it to be like a steakhouse. I want sort of an a la carte menu of the things that I can go and use that are available so I can test them and vet them and feel see if they work for me. Meaning that let me go pick a couple of different models that have been, you know, hosted through an API and let me, you know, see if that my, you know, the front end services that I'm using are efficient enough to, you know, get the right responses that I need. And then let me then determine how I should scale that. Am I deploying it in my data center? Am I deploying it at the edge? Am I deploying it on a laptop? You know, where does it go? That tends to dictate the architecture many times, right? I think large language models, you know, massive ones hosting multiple applications is something that you could do, right? But you have to have the infrastructure to do it, right? That's the key. I think what we'll see is that you probably, the easiest way to do this would be take some of the smaller models, fine tune those models, create a card catalog of models that you have that are tuned for different respects and or different contexts, and then let those teams consume those. Now, of course, the question is how do I know what to train it with, right? So eventually there'll be a business within, say, IT that says, hey, tell me what you need. Here's them. I've got some trusted models that I've governed, that I'm governing because I know they're commercially viable. They're not, you know, they haven't been trained on synthetic data from another AI bot, Then all of a sudden, I don't trust any of the data. So I'm trusting, I'm building governance around the models that I can, you know, rely on. And then I'm exposing those to data sets within the business, and I'm helping those businesses train those models effectively to create their model, right? So they can go and use that. And then I'm hosting that for them however I need to, right? Because the idea is I probably want to centralize some of these things, so that's the easiest way to manage it. And you may still have a sort of a hybrid approach to how you either have the core of your data center hosting the bulk of the infrastructure for your models, and then maybe you're pushing something to the edge and you're doing a very lightweight approach to that, and or you're putting some services in the cloud and you have your, you know, core services back on-prem. Those are, I think hybrid will play a key role in all of this, right? On how you architect it and how you scale it and how you expose access to these things. I mean, we're seeing a resurgence, I guess, or maybe a, you know, this idea of moving back from the cloud, right? I mean, there's a lot of customers who are like, you know, I really can't control my cost there effectively. I don't love that my data is out there. Yeah, I think it's pretty secure, but I'm not 100% all the time. I want to bring it back in. I want to optimize my cost with the resources. I want to optimize my cost with my data, because what we're seeing is data is going to become the lifeline for your business, right? It is the most important asset that companies have, and it's the most untapped asset, right? They don't know how to leverage it to monetize it, and Gen AI and these language models are going to hopefully provide a mechanism to do that, right? And so I think that's the next phase is taking data, having it in the right places, being able to build card catalogs of models that you trust that you can expose to different business units so they can then tap into these data lakes with their data lake house, you know, and then feed that to fine tune a model and consume it through their applications to help drive either, you know, an experience with their sales force to help streamline how they interact with customers for RFPs and things like that. And there's a litany of use cases. They're almost endless, right? And so I think that's what we're seeing happen. And I think we'll see that continue to happen. But again, no one size fits all. And that's what the large language model was trying to accomplish. And we're already seeing that say, that doesn't work for me. You know, I need to have something that's more consumable and more scalable and more distributable in order for me to be able to adopt it in a timely manner and to be able to make good decisions. Because at the end of the day, if I'm investing in AI, I've got to show return on investment and time to value. If I can't do that, I've got to pivot.
Yeah. So you gave me so much to unpack. One of the things that you mentioned was about fine-tuning, like, and the untapped data that organizations have. So one thing that I do notice is that a lot of organizations underestimate the effort it takes to actually generate a good data set to do fine-tuning. And then if we offset it against the functionality of RAG, there's always this question, hey, I've got this data source that I'm going to embed inside a vector database, and that vector database will provide me the large language model the answers to generate a response. Why do I still need to focus on building data sets for fine-tuning? Is the RAG model or the RAG architecture, is that enough? So what's your opinion about that? With the rise of RAG, do organizations still need to fine-tune large language models?
Yeah, because remember, the models are still, you know, could be somewhat large. Think about a 70 billion parameter model, which is really not that large, but it's, you know, a little bit large, right? It's like the small little, right? But those still require a fair amount of resources to host and to make efficient. So the answer is it starts with the what's happening with small language models is you're adapting new mathematics or mathematical ways of creating those models so that it takes less time, less compute, that they can be more accurate. And what that does is then allows you to then, if you do augment it with the RAG, that the RAG is really meant for new data that's coming in. So I don't have to necessarily go through the training exercise, but I want to get to a lightweight model. I want to get to an efficient model as fast as I can, and then maybe augment that with my data, because I know my data is coming from multiple sources and it may be hard to aggregate that to actually do a retraining effectively. So another thing is, again, remember, companies already have, we've already been doing RAG, right? We've been doing it with databases and, you know, all these different elastic searches and all these other elements. We've built these knowledge sources already, right? Went through the whole NoSQL and caching phase to make it fast. You know, we're just adding in these language models. That's the new sort of shiny object, right? And so I think RAG is going to serve a great purpose initially. I think over time, we'll see efficiencies happen and that these retraining of models will happen so quickly and so efficiently that you may not need as much of the RAG, right? If I can retrain a model in an hour and distribute that pretty quickly, do I need to have the RAG? Do I need to have maybe the additional overhead or complexity that the RAG would add into the equation? So, you know, it's here for now, for sure, and it's going to stay here for now. I think over time we'll see if it can, you know, tell the test of time, because I'm not sure that you really want it there long term if you don't need it.
So is that a benefit of a smaller language model, having the capability of train faster or fine tune faster?
Yeah, just again, it depends, right? So take the scenario of an edge use case, right? Where I've built a model, I know I had to make it smaller, say sub 5 million parameters, right? And I had to distribute that model to an edge location where I have smaller form factors of software, of hardware, and less resources. But I know that there's a fair amount of data generation happening there, right? Once I create the SLM and distribute that, I may not want to change it much because that's time consuming and resource constraints at the edge don't exist. They don't, you know, I don't have the resources to train it there. So, but I've got new data happening all the time. So I want to have real time. So I would implement a RAG in that use case, right? So that as the data comes in, I can leverage it quickly and I'm getting real time feedback and information. That to me is a great use case, right? I think for the larger organizations that have a big data center and have lots of accelerators and all those things, that maybe being able to retrain quickly, I mean, theoretically, if you have a small language model and you have enough GPUs, you can probably train it in minutes, right? Once you get really efficient at it over time, right? Depending upon how much data is coming in, how much you're trying to retrain with. So I think, again, we'll see this idea of what does a dynamic training exercise look like for models and how then you distribute those to almost like a blue-green sort of canary deployment model where you deploy the new one and you slowly, you know, direct traffic to the new model and you just keep doing that and cascading that over time. And so that the models are constantly just being refreshed, right? But it's going to take, you know, sort of evolution in the methodology to do that efficiently. So we're just not there yet, right? I think it's pretty progressive, and I think that we need to let it play out, right? Let RAG do what it's supposed to do to help with the legacy of the world that we have today around knowledge sources and augmenting these models. And then over time, let's see if we can make them a lot more dynamic and have the agility to train them quickly and see if RAG makes sense at that point.
Yeah, and especially with that, those smaller models, like you said about efficiency, but also about the capabilities of deploying it everywhere. And if we look at the early large language models, you need to have multiple GPUs in order to run it, let alone serve multiple users at the same time. Now, if we want to take one step back, is there a industry standard definition already about what a small language model is compared to a large language model? Or is there another definition that's also on the horizon?
Yeah, I think when you ask the question, the first sort of inclination is to say, talk about size, right? I don't think that's what SLMs are about. SLMs are about efficiencies. They're about, you know, moving from a proximal policy, you know, optimization, what they call PPO or reinforcement learning, to a a direct preference optimization, you know, methodology or mathematical approach, right? And as you move from PPO to DPO, that allows you to really avoid a lot of the bumps that were being realized because you can do things much more efficiently. You don't require like a reward model, which you would require with, you know, doing reinforcement learning. You have to train a model to then can measure your model. Well, that's not super efficient because now I've got to retrain that every time I get new data and I've got to maintain that reward model. I think so, you know, again, size matters, of course, to some extent, but it's more about efficiencies. It's about the methodologies where, you know, a PPO methodology requires just good answers. It wants just good answers. But if you adopt a DPO methodology, you need good and bad answers, right? And now it's going to help you drive sort of governance into the fine-tuning aspects of your model so that you have inherent guardrails, right? And that you're going to get to an answer faster that's more accurate and avoid the pitfalls of, you know, some of the hallucinations and those things because it finds the right answer. I mean, that's the problem with models today is when they don't find a good answer, they create an answer. And so, you know, that's not good for any of us, right? And I think that's the area where we're seeing, again, I think we'll see some huge growth, not in just so, you know, so to answer your question, it's size, it's about optimization, it's about a better methodology for doing it so that you can get better outcomes for the models with the fine tuning. And it's about being able to remove some of the old technical debt, like, you know, having a reward model, things like that, in order to be able to accurately measure, because humans are expensive, right? So we need ways to augment the people because you can't have people always interacting with these things at scale. So that's, I think, what SLMs are. The sizing itself is going to continue to change, right? Somebody, you know, the Pi 2 came out from Microsoft. That was pretty darn good. You know, obviously, Mistral came out with Mixtral and their, you know, their methodology for, you know, being able to get really good performance and accuracy with a much smaller model than the, say, the Llama 270 billion was pretty impressive, right? And so I think it's going to continue to evolve. I think they'll get smaller. I don't know if there's going to be one right size. We don't know that yet. I think the industry's looked at 70 billion parameter models as about the right smaller size model because they have a fairly good amount of accuracy and they've got a lot of context, obviously, and a lot of sort of experience in their parameters and things like that. I learned something recently where, you know, the average human will only ever consume about a billion parameters, right? Think about that. And what is it? ChatGPT 4 is like 1.4 trillion parameters, right? So, and we're obviously way more advanced than ChatGPT. We have, our cognition's better. We're obviously using much less power. Like, we are the SLM, right? Our brains are in some ways. And that's what we want to start moving the technology towards, is to be more like our minds, be more efficient. And I think we're going to continue to see that happen and we'll drive towards being more like a human mind.
So there are benefits of an SLM for the data scientist because they can use different optimization methods in order to fine-tune or to train that model. But there's also optimizations for the infrastructure people, right? Can you go over those one a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think that's what I was kind of alluding to some extent is, you know, if I'm constantly just consuming infrastructure over time, that doesn't work, right? Like we know data centers are already constrained today, right? And so when you start introducing accelerators to that story, right? I mean, people don't want to talk about it, but let's just give an example. If I drop a 8-way system in a rack in my lab, right? I may consume the entire rack power of that lab, depending upon how old it is. You know, for a long time, 7 to 15 kilowatts was not the average amount of power for a rack. And so, you know, these large accelerator systems will eat up the entire rack with one or two systems. So now I've got, you know, great. I've got 12 U of system and the rest of the rack is empty. Is that good? I don't know. Probably not. Right. And so I think we need to be smart with how we adopt the technology, and we really need to be smart with how we consume the things that we're creating, how they consume the infrastructure. So, you know, the world of, you know, a lot of AI lives and dies under a desk, right? And that's not good because now I've got these systems under desks that aren't being well utilized, you know, and so we want to get those systems into a central location so we can maximize resources, right? And then once we maximize, you know, how we configure the architectures and the data centers and make sure that we can do, you know, have low latency networking and things like that, then we need to open the aperture to the business and say, hey, I want everyone to come consume this. I mean, let's be honest, Frank, you know this really well. Like, that's something our company does really well, right? We expose infrastructure to a broad set of you know, the business, and we try to drive operational efficiency. And so I think what I'm seeing is it's going to be really important on how you monitor your gear, you know, how do you monitor the expensive resources. How do you place the workload in the right place? Meaning that don't oversize it. Yeah. Yep. You know, the world of the data scientists requesting the, you know, how much CPU and stuff they need will go away. They should focus on their data. They should focus on, you know, the outcomes of their models and algorithms and stuff like that, and let the infrastructure guys help them right size what they're doing over time, because they tend to over ask, right? We all tend to over ask for everything that we want. And so we're going to have to really be smart about how we right-size the workloads, distribute the workloads, and by the way, evolve where they land, because over time, workloads change. And so we need to be able to monitor and measure how something's running and say, you know what, that workload actually, based on the usage or organic growth or whatever it is, the code changing, could run better over another set of clusters, another set of hardware, and I can then, you know, alleviate some heat or alleviate some stress on this other cluster. So it's going to become this exercise of balancing how we distribute these workloads across our data centers and really drive utilization up as high as we can, because we're going to be constrained by space, power, and cooling. You know, I obviously manage several labs and have been playing with, you know, accelerators for a long time. And we recently got squeezed into a smaller space, and it, power and heat are real, my friend. Like, it's no joke. And, you know, when you start, when like accelerator or GPUs get hot, guess what? They fail. And that's not fun if you're running a job that takes a day or two or 30 days. If your GPUs start to fail and you don't have really good resiliency built into how that job is running, you got to start over. And so I think, again, it's going to be a dance to some extent on how we manage the underlying infrastructure, manage power, manage cooling, manage how much capacity you actually need, and then start optimizing now. We can't start optimizing later, right? If we do, we're going to run out of space. We're going to run out of so many things. We've already seen this happen, right? We ran out of silicon. You can't get devices because everybody wanted them so quickly, and we weren't prepared to be able to deliver them with the scale that we, you know, that's happening today. And so what does that mean? It means that we're already being squeezed. We're already being asked to do more. The world of, hey, do I need a GPU or do I need a CPU for AI? Let's be honest. 80% or so of AI is still running on CPU, right? No one normally talks about that, but that's what they have, right? And so they're doing it on CPU today. I think GPUs are amazing, and I think they have their place in the ecosystem, but they're not the end-all be-all, right, for everything. Over time, will that change as they become more efficient and as they become more specialized? I do think we'll see an era of specialized accelerators that will do things, specific things, more effectively and at a much lower footprint, lower power consumption, and all those things. But again, we haven't quite gotten there yet. So that was a long answer, but I think that the infrastructure and how we treat it is going to change. We can't be lazy anymore, right? Hyperscalers allowed people to be lazy with code and because they wanted you to consume more resources. But guess what? Now they're having the same paradigm shift. It's like, oh, whoa, these new AI resources really are eating up my power too. And so I can't be lazy either. So now I need to force developers to be smarter and more judicious with how they design things. And that's why we're seeing, you know, the evolution of LLM to SLM to XLM. Right. And
what's that?
Well, XLM is everything LM, right? You know, you're going to see, you know, large vision models. You're going to see models that will become customized for things like cybersecurity. Like it's going to really, you know, it's really driving innovation in a way that allows us to hopefully avert a lot of the sort of negative things that are out in the world. Cyber is a great one, right? I mean, AI is a really good tool for people that want to do bad things, unfortunately, right? And there's no way to 100% avoid that. So how do we allow cyber to have, models running on laptops? Because laptops are now being powered by AI, cores and CPUs. So how do we put small models on, say, a laptop and have the ability to, when something happens, engage with that model and say, hell, what's going on? And they can tell me how to fix a problem. It may tell you to shut it off, right, at some point. Unplug your laptop because you're being, phished or whatever. But I think that's the key, is that there's the threat surface has gotten much broader in the world of it, because AI has been able to, do that. And it, for lack of a better word, I know it's buzzy, but it's democratized sort of nefarious, natures. So now anybody can kind of jump into this game of trying to make money off people and fleecing people. And that's a dangerous space. So we've got to get smarter about how we use the technology to handle this flood of things that are happening. And also we'll eventually see the tiering of AI, right? Today we have the co-pilot model. Then you'll move into, as you stair step up, you'll have agents, and then eventually you'll have functions of AI that are doing things. I think there will also be a lot of AI to manage AI, because we'll have to do that. And the AI will actually understand the AI better than we do, because it's AI. It's like expecting AI to understand you, Frank, your mind, your emotions. It's not going to do that very well, right? I can hopefully somewhat understand them. I mean, you're a complex person, my friend, but but we all are, right? And I think, so the key is, that eventually AI is going to have to help us manage AI, because it can do it more efficiently and effectively and do it faster, right, at some point.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that one. It's going to be a very interesting thing. And one of the key elements that you said about, it's about space, it's about heat, it's about energy. And we typically talk in data centers, but what about edge? Because if you think about where the functionality really needs to be, is at the edge. But those elements that you just described don't really match the edge description.
Yeah, I think that's what's in some ways driving this. So, I was just recently at a conference by one of the big silicon providers, and they had a panel, and one of the gentlemen on the stage was really talking about the need for SLMs and why they're so important. And it's because there's a lot of elements that make it important, but it's access, right? It's, access to these resources in a way that you'll never get a large language model to work. So to your point, data gravity is still very real. And the edge is where the data really is being generated. So you've got to be able to put a model in the path of data at the edge to drive not only adoption, but to drive business value. You take, for instance, a retail shop or a fast food restaurant. Imagine being able to have a small model there that's running, and then you're engaging with that model via the employees that are there to improve the queuing system of their drive-through. Or you have kiosks there that have an avatar that are engaging with the customers on customer service things. Maybe it's not the food part of it, but maybe they have that problem. They can talk to this avatar and say, "Hey, my order's wrong." It says, "Okay, sorry about that. Let me get that fixed for you." So it doesn't require a human to do that, right? We're trying to figure out ways to be smarter with how we use the humans or use us, because we are adept and we can adapt more readily. Let us do higher function things, and let the AI do the lower function things, if you will, because they can, right? And so I think edge is going to play a huge part. The problem right now, though, is getting resources at the edge. Everything we're talking about requires more. And so how do we get to a place or a posture where, as we look to the edge as being the new data center, right, how do we start to create an ecosystem of things, whether it's your core, thick edge, thin edge, far edge elements that are working in sort of an orchestra or symphony of things to actually deliver a workload? I think that's going to take time, because, again, it's highly distributed and you've got to be efficient with how you don't move data. I think federated machine learning will start to become more prevalent, right? We've seen that kind of quiet down. I think we'll start to see that come back at some point, because now we'll have more AI at the edge, and that AI will want to work together as almost like a beehive, right? Because the collective power of those resources is better than a single resource. But again, you know, I think what we'll see, again, the tiering is going to be data centers that have the large language models. You'll have, you know, remote offices that may have LLMs as well, but probably SLMs, right? And then you'll start looking at the laptop as being the next, like, what's the nano language model or whatever we call that, that really small, efficient, super high function or super, you know, singular function model going to look like. And we may have multiple models running on our devices, right, in order to achieve different functions and different capabilities. And so I think it's all going to come down to where do we interact today, right? Where are you sitting? Where am I sitting? I'm at home, right? I'm at the edge. And, you know, I know we're all coming back to the offices, whether we like it or not these days. So we're coming back into central places where it makes it easier to work and have data in one place. But the reality of the world is we're all distributed. We're all an edge point. And so if we want to make this technology work for the world and for everybody, it's going to have to distribute. It's going to have to be more resilient. It's going to have to be more efficient. And it's going to have to, at the end of the day, you know, hopefully drive a healthy adoption and a healthy outcome.
Yeah, I think that's the trend. We need to figure out where to run the intelligence, right? And as close to the human as possible, as close to the data generation as possible. And typically those two go hand in hand. So you already mentioned a couple of things for the future to talk about XLM. But do you see other interesting or exciting trends happening in the development of machine learning or AI?
I think it's in the math. I mean, I think there's a lot of progress happening. And, you know, I'm no mathematician personally. I think math is amazing and it's beautiful and it is all around us. And but I think, you know, the stuff happening in the algebraic world and all those other areas that where they're really driving efficiencies, I think that's going to help us get to the next level of things, right? So it starts with, you know, numbers, probably ends with numbers too, because everybody's looking to make money. But I think, so that's one area that I'm interested in. I think also, you know, if you look at how we treat the technology today, we use, transformers, and those in some ways are somewhat lazy. You kind of cram all the data with a transformer into a GPU, which requires a massive amount of power. And then, you know, over time, that's not very efficient. So hopefully the evolution of neural networks and how we treat, you know, the models and the algorithms will get us to a better, more efficient, space. So we can continue to evolve the technology, and it doesn't become just a hindrance, right? And just a power suck or just a financial suck. I think that's going to be key. And, you know, I think obviously the incredible Hulk of the industry right now, you know, they have motivations and they're leading the charge right now. And I think, but I think eventually the market's going to diversify more effectively, and the diversification will be driven by efficiencies, be driven by flexibility and choice. And hopefully that competitive landscape will allow us to continue to push forward with, you know, XLMs, right? You know, basically taking the value of what all this data can do and driving a better interaction model so we can actually expose the technology to everyone. I mean, that's the key, right? It needs to be accessible to the masses in a way that's not talking about transformers, but it's talking about engaging with an interface, right? That's why I said earlier, the packaging of these things is going to be so critical, because we can't make everyone a data scientist. We can't make everyone a machine learning engineer. That's just not feasible. And I'm not sure it's necessary, but we do want to make sure that the technology is tangible. We want to make sure the technology is accessible. We want to make sure that the technology is efficient. And so I think that's what's going to have to happen. It starts with the math, though. And so as long as we see really smart people that are a lot smarter than me continue to push the envelope there, then I think we'll be successful. And then the only thing that I'll have to have then play a role in the technology adoption is that we, for lack of a better word, sort of protect ourselves from ourselves with the technology so that we can use it in a way that does sort of better mankind or, you know, womankind, any kind, and make sure that it doesn't just become a thorn in our side, right?
Yeah, use technology for good, like how Pat would say it.
Yeah.
So Any final thoughts for our listeners interested in exploring SLMs or maybe XLMs for their on-prem AI endeavors?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, it's funny, like I was trying to, you know, what is the best path, right? There's so much information out there. There's Coursera, there's Andrew Ng, I think from, you know, Stanford, who has a lot of stuff out there about machine learning. And he's got a new sort of, you know, not new, but he's got a company that's doing really cool stuff around the large, you know, vision models. But I think a couple of things. First of all, you have to stay hungry for knowledge, right? It may, a lot of this stuff seems highly unapproachable, but it doesn't have to be. So I, you know, I recommend go and look for an outlet to learn about what an LLM is, what SLM is. There's a lot of, you know, obviously with the emergence of things like GitHub, you can go find kind of anything you want. And typically things are already curated, so you can start playing with them. So I don't think you have to start with an SLM. Go figure out what a RAG architecture looks like. Go find a project on GitHub that helps you deploy a RAG on a small, you know, environment. If you have one in a little home lab. But I actually found a link to the data of someone who is showing how to run an SLM on your laptop. And they provide step-to-step, you know, step-by-step guidance on how you do it. It just runs a little Docker runtime on your laptop. And it gives you sort of the educational process that you need to have to understand, you know, what the math is, what the algorithms are. You don't have to know all of it. And by the way, I don't know all of these things, you know, expert-wise. I understand them enough. I understand them enough to drive an outcome. And I think that's the key, is being able to, it's all very cool, but if you can't drive something that's going to change the world or change your landscape or help you evolve your customer, whatever, then it's pointless, right? So you have to figure out how to drive outcome-based you know, things. And so learning enough about the technology and learning how to actually deliver something is the key. So, you know, go and look at Coursera, go look at all the other different, you know, YouTube channels. There's a litany of things out there, but find one thing and dive in and don't be scared.
Coursera is awesome. It's really awesome.
Yeah, it is.
So thanks, Chris, for this awesome episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Frank, I appreciate your time. I appreciate having an opportunity to just talk and in some ways probably pontificate about these technologies. I hope the listeners enjoyed it. I hope they they learned something new maybe. And I look forward to coming back when these things have all changed in the next 2 months and talking about the next thing.
Will do. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it. We reached the end of another episode of the Unexplored Territory podcast. If I have to summarize today's episode, my key takeaways would be that models will come in all different sizes. And there's no hard and fast rule for a successful deployed architecture. The size of the model should align with the purpose of its function. We will enter a time where we do not talk about large language models or small language models, but right-sized models. Same goes for the infrastructure supporting the GenAI architecture. Again, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast or rate it anywhere possible. If you have any feedback, please send us a message on Twitter at UnexploredPod. I would like to thank our guest today, Chris Gully, for a fantastic episode.